So, welcome again, everyone. That was an interesting, I don't know how it was for you. It's an interesting experience during the sitting. Anyone have any strong physical sensations during the sit? Yeah. So there was this noticing of it's quite hot in this room, as those of you who've been here in person know. And there's this kind of delight of actually being in a room with other bodies. And there's a lot of heat. So there's this experience of some delight and some connection, but also and a deep willingness to be with the heat, but also this kind of longing to remove the layers again, you know. So wires are one layer, microphones, screens, masks, sound. There's just a longing to just be completely intimate with experience, right? Without layers. I was feeling this during the sit and feeling into that. I feel like it's a wholesome longing of the heart. So in the Buddhist tradition, this is chanda, right? This is wholesome desire or motivation. This is the heart's yearning for awakening, for freedom, for full expression, service. This is a kind of wholesome desire that's different than tanha or craving that gets fixated on an object. I need it to be this way right now in order to feel better. Right? Tanha gets fixated on the object. Chanda is a wholesome, less object-driven movement towards a kind of openness that at our depths we know is possible. We know it's possible. So after feeling a bit of that during the sit, also reflecting on this intention in continuing to wear masks and do whatever we need to do to not cause harm. Feeling the intentionality behind that, the good reason behind that, and the care behind that. So as much as this might kind of chafe right now, feel a little trapped, being able to feel into a deeper intentionality for why we're doing what we're doing. Sitting together in a room, but also these restrictions, right? Part of us, some of us being here, we're doing this to cause the least amount of harm possible. And to feel that is good, not in a self-congratulatory way, but in that kind of the wholesome desire, the wholesome movement of the heart that doesn't want to cause harm. So wasn't expecting that preamble, but the talk tonight is on devotion. And it's the theme for the week. And when Tuari asked me to speak about that, I was delighted because it's been an increasing part of my own practice. It's not something that's often talked about in a very direct way. You know, we bow, we ring the bell, we have some formality, at least in this kind of insight meditation scene. Sometimes we dedicate merit or chant a little bit, but often, at least in this scene, it's not at the center of things. So I was inspired by this theme, and a lot has come up around it. But it's funny to give a talk on devotion, because devotion is all about embodying, expressing, and fully inhabiting our deepest aspiration. Right? It's not so much about talking about reasoning out or, you know, explaining why the heart should leap. You know, it's a bit counterintuitive that way. So I wanted to just share a story that I found inspiring. So a chant, and if we have time, maybe we'll do it in a kind of weird hybrid fashion at the end. But on the website of the nuns in Northern California called Aloka Vihara, they had a chant that was inspired by the abbot of the Berkeley Monastery in Northern California. And his name is Reverend Heng Shor. And in the late 70s, he and a fellow monk, his name was Heng Chow, I believe, undertook a pilgrimage that they called Three Steps and a Bow. And they started in Southern California and walked however many miles to Northern California, to the city of the 10,000 Buddhas, a monastery in Northern California. It took them 2.5 years. And they walked by taking three steps and a bow. So they would take three steps, they would do a full prostration, and they would get back up and walk three more steps and bow and do a full prostration. They called this a walk for peace, inner peace and outer peace. And they said of this journey that it was like walking through their own minds. They met everything. They met danger, people who wanted to kill them. They met immense generosity, people walking with them, wanting to offer them things, help support them in any way they could. They met people who wanted to walk with them for long stretches and just talk. They met all different sorts of weather, different kinds of weather. But it was this journey for inner and outer peace. And that image of them taking three steps and a bow has been extremely inspiring to me. As the devotional heart yearns, I think, for a full expression like that, something that engages our whole body. And so the tale of their journey is really interesting. They had a lot to say about it. Anyway. But this is one comment that Heng Chow made. And he said the difference, but he was talking about the difference between adults who came across their path and kids, because there were both. He said, adults want to know what we're doing. When adults want to know what we're doing, they ask and they talk. When children want to know what we are doing, they watch and bow along. This is the direct Buddha Dhamma. Children learn by doing. They fidget and fall asleep with words and talking. All of the words of wisdom are in your own heart, so why waste time listening to someone else speak them? The Buddha Dhamma is the same. The principles in the texts come from our own hearts. The wisdom and happiness of all Buddhas comes from our own minds. So devotion has this directness about it. This directness. In a way, it's calling us to kind of enact our awakening. invoking our deepest heart. So for many of us, especially, you know, those of us in which, who have been raised in cultures in which the intellect and reason are really prized. They're really prized. Without getting off on too much of a tangent, I'm reading a book called The Master and His Emissary, which maybe many of you have read some of, but it kind of outlines how Western civilization has come to be left hemisphere dominant. So the part of the brain that breaks things into parts, that sees things piecemeal, that's more mechanistic, this than that. It's either this or that. It's more literal. And this right hemisphere of the brain is much more in touch with a holistic sense, the context in which we're living, how systems and structures fit together. It's involved more with empathy. And it's also involved a lot more with subtlety. So according to this writer, Ian McGilchrist, I think. But at the expense of praising reason, and both need each other. So the purpose of the book is to show that we need both, but we've gotten out of balance in that this kind of reductive mechanistic part of the brain has become dominant, and the kind of more holistic sense has not been developed to the same degree. So really, if we kind of work to reverse the relationship, that's kind of the, would restore the proper balance. So one of the things that we can do is work with symbols, the things that aren't so literal, that aren't so much about making a logical argument with bullet points. You know, we don't need to surrender our common sense, but dealing with things more, have more to do with feeling tone, how we're affected, and just the sense of the whole. So how do these two things relate? So when we do devotional practice, in reading this book, I was aware that we're strengthening, or maybe we're starting to shift this relationship a little bit. We still use reason and the rational mind, but we're inclining more towards things like beauty, things that uniquely kind of open and draw the heart out into a wider, more holistic sense of wholeness. But for most of us, because of our religious and maybe other conditioning, devotion sometimes makes us a little bit queasy. Anyone have any queasiness when they hear the word devotion? Hands going right up here in the room. Yeah. Devotion makes us a little bit queasy. So I know when I first walked into a room filled with people meditating silently, no bowing, no imagery, just people sitting silently, my heart was extremely inspired and moved. Oh, just this, oh, this. there was this an immediate feeling of uplift and resonance and possibility. Knew I was in the right place. It was extremely challenging, but I was in the right place and I knew that it was beneficial. When I first walked into a room where people were chanting, 20 some years ago now, I felt a bit sick to my stomach, that I was going to be asked to swallow Kool-Aid, or I was going to get roped into something against my will. And I couldn't even explain it. I just felt kind of a queasiness. So I think this is interesting to pay attention to. And I think what I want to just offer or suggest that maybe we explore is some around that conditioning to devotion, maybe in the favor of the rational reason, which we need, but we kind of prize above all else. But also to consider that there are many different forms that devotion can take. And sometimes we get a little stuck on the form that devotion is taking. So I have two grandparents who passed away a long time ago, but were a big part of my life and very inspiring as sort of models of integrity and living a virtuous life. And they had very different expressions of devotion. So my grandmother would get up in the middle of the night because it was the only time she had alone and would write ecstatic poems to God or however she was understanding God at the time. Just this overflow of love. And my grandfather, who lived to be 98 and lived in the same house for 60 years, faithfully just tended the garden and tended the raspberries. And his expression of devotion was no less sincere or strong, but it took a very different form. And he always thought that hers was better because she felt this rapturous intensity that needed this poetic expression. And in some ways, I think she also admired and deeply respected his. So to allow devotion to take a lot of different forms, but to understand that at its heart, it's about a deep expression of respect. Like, what is worthy of honor and respect? And that's different for each of us. Something different is going to spark in each of us around that. So we can't sort of dictate what direction devotion is going to take. But to ask, like, what is really worthy of honor and respect? So in the traditional teachings, in the lists, devotion, again, much like a lot of our other conditioning, gets overshadowed by this quality of diligence. And there's some overlap there. This deep commitment to kind of staying with, holding to our intention. Yeah, that's the three steps aspect of that practice of three steps and a bow. The diligence kind of keeps us on course. But this word that comes up again and again in the texts in the Pali is atapi, A-T-A-P-I. And the root of that is the same root as tapas, which means heat or warmth. So sometimes that gets translated as a kind of strenuous, diligent, dutiful effort that takes some rigor. But it's also translated as ardency, which has the same root as ardor or love, passion, right? So deep care. So I think the important part there is that devotion as it relates to energy and effort. So the five faculties or capacities that we're encouraged and can notice developing in our practice start with faith. Faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So I think of devotion as faith energy or trust energy. So contacting what's worthy of respect and honor, and then trusting it. So there's warmth in it. There's fire and diligence because it's painful often, to sit in a hot room for 2 hours. There's heat, right? But the warmth of the heart opening towards what it most values or loves, there's that is also a kind of heat or atapi, ardency. So in the refrain, or kind of like the chorus of the four foundations of mindfulness, this is repeated over and over again. One abides contemplating the body, feelings, mental states, phenomena, ardent, alert, clearly knowing, mindful, right? Ardent, warm, devoted, committed, faith energy. This precedes mindfulness. This is kind of the way that we are mindful, a kind of attitude or tone that we can bring to it. So again, what sparks that in each of us is going to be different. But the other thing that it does is it gives us a willingness to meet and bear with what may be difficult to meet. So it gives us the openness and willingness to bear with what might be difficult to meet. So even though there may be a warmth and emotionality in it, and it can start out as this kind of bright faith, okay? Or this, I think of it as the kind of warmth of falling in love, okay? When all of a sudden everything's possible. There's this overflow. You don't have to try to stay focused on the object of your attention. You're wrapped. Think of this sometimes. This happened more early on, but I can still swoon at a Dharma talk. If anyone else can. Might just be a weird thing. But can actually swoon at the beauty of a Dharma talk, right? Just the language and the expression. And when someone is completely embodying and expressing their integrity, it's beautiful. And there's just this urge to bow to that, first to be around it and to learn about it, but also just to bow. A deep acknowledgement of that. So in the beginning, it can have that quality of bright faith, just that kind of glow of possibility. But as it deepens, devotional energy really can become that heartfelt commitment, right? That willingness to be with things even as they're difficult. So an image came to mind. I do a lot of caregiving work and work with elderly, aging, and people who are near the end of their life. And many years ago, I was bringing someone, elderly client, and her dog on a ferry. We were waiting in a really long ferry line. And bringing her back to a place that she really cared about. So waiting in line, car without air conditioning, windows open, dog pacing back and forth, uncomfortable, person, the woman I was caring for, also confused and uncomfortable. And there was sun kind of coming in on every side, and she was sensitive to sun. So I was going back and forth, trying to fix the windows, trying to give her a shade, trying to feed the dog, trying to make sure she had enough water. And I was going in and out of the car, just trying to make sure she was comfortable and wouldn't get too warm in this car. So there was just this movement, as often many of us who are caring for other people have, this movement of the heart that is just attending moment by moment, right? And this is I think of this as this aspect of devotion, where we unselfconsciously just slip out of the straitjacket of self-concern, right? That small preoccupation with, how am I doing? Is it okay? Are they, all of that. And just attending to the dharma of the moment, what needs to be done at the moment. Anyway, I'm circling, basically circumambulating this car, trying to keep the dog, all of us comfortable and not dehydrated. And this man gets out of his big truck, comes down and said, I just want to tell you, you are the most devoted daughter I have ever seen. And I said, well, I'm not her daughter. And I hadn't thought of it that way. I hadn't been viewing myself from the outside as I normally would have been. Right? Just offering. So I think of this sometimes and considering different expressions that devotion might take. And certainly we're not meant to be martyrs or not look after our own needs, but just to recognize that this natural movement of the heart of love really is sometimes active and expressing itself in ways that we might not be so aware of. So in the movement of devotion and thinking about how we might enact or work with this in a daily way, there are some gestures that seem important to mention. If we're kind of sparking or invoking a different aspect of our being rather than the kind of mechanistic, task-oriented, relational, or kind of reductive mind, it's very helpful to engage all of the senses, engage the body, and engage other forms of attention. Right? So we do this when we enact the ritual of meditation. We bring awareness to the senses, right? We feel ourselves present in the room. But with devotional practice, often we're chanting or at least repeating a sound. So it's like all the attention goes, gathers and collects in that sound. It could be as simple as Buddha, awake, awake, here, here. So devotional practices often have a lot of repetition in them, which is very frustrating to the rational mind, right? It's like, I heard this already. Let's get to the new stuff. But it's this call to remember, to recollect, right? Just to remember. So if we look at an image that inspires us, or we repeat a sound, or we open to beauty in some form, it's like we're taking something that's internal, bringing it external, giving it form, and then relating to it. So it's not that we're worshiping something completely external to us, we're finding expressions for what reminds us of what we most deeply value, where we find the deepest connection, and then we're relating to it. We might offer a flower. We might light a candle. We might bow in front of an image. So all the other aspects of our being can be engaged in that full-heartedly. I've been fortunate to sit quite a bit with Ajahn Suchito. Maybe some of you have also during the pandemic. He's been offering a tremendous amount of teachings online, retreats. He's a British monk in the Thai forest tradition and has just a beautiful, inspiring way of talking about devotion, but also expressing it. So when I first was on a live retreat with him, it was this incredible moment of watching him come into a room just slowly, 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 as though he had all the time in the world, right? I think it probably took him, so here we are with the three steps and a bow again. I think it took him, it felt like 5 minutes to get to the front of the room, okay? Just step as though he had all the time in the world. Where am I going to go? That kind of feeling, which is the ritual of walking meditation. I'm walking just to be walking, okay? So he walks to the front of the room, pours water into a bowl. So simple. Just this pouring of water into a bowl and then offers it to the Buddha. This fluidity, this changingness, water. So often the elements are represented in devotional practices as well. Elements that are within us, earth, air, fire, water, and external to us. So he offers a flower, lights the incense, does a simple bow, and waits. Everybody's waiting for his words, his talk, his wisdom, right? But he's embodying this beautifully uncomplicated, wholehearted gesture of devotion. And it was so moving and inspiring to me. And listening to him talk a lot more about it, to kind of find rituals that take us out of our task orientation. I pour the water because I want something to drink, or because it needs to be poured. I pour it in the gesture of offering. Right? Doesn't matter really what I'm offering to, but I'm offering. And in that, part of that practice reminds us in an engaged, kind of embodied way, we can then use some of our thinking to recollect qualities. So this is a skillful use of our thinking. And his word for this, which I really appreciate and use all the time now, is linger. Call to mind these qualities, and traditionally qualities of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, qualities of wakefulness, clear seeing, knowingness, qualities of the teachings, which invite and guest investigation, which are said to be present here and now, which are timeless, direct, leading onward. And the qualities of the Sangha, those who've practiced well, those who have wholesome intentions. So to take one phrase and recollect it, remember it, linger over it. Not analyze it, not pick it apart, but just what is that? What's the heart resonant quality when I say something like integrity? Those who practice well, those who practice wholeheartedly with integrity. So we're not trying to make ourselves feel a certain way or demand that the heart open, but it's kind of like we're knocking on it. We're calling it. So it doesn't matter so much, but you know, sometimes it flies all the way open and there's this outpouring of inspiration, motivation, expression. Sometimes there's just a quiet little resonance. Sometimes there's a strengthening of intention. Sometimes we don't feel much at all. But this is where the diligence comes in. We take three more steps, we bow again. So in devotional practice, we return to this over and over and over again. We give it all the time in the world. We let the rational, kind of logistical, task-oriented mind be in the background. And we just let the heart relate and respond to its deepest aspirations. So this is Hafiz, the poet. How did the rose ever open its heart and give to this world all its beauty? It felt the encouragement of light against its being. Otherwise, we all remain too frightened. So my questions maybe for you to consider. So part of devotion to me, moving into these practices, is creating a space in which we can surrender. I've been thinking about it as surrendering our complaint, surrendering our kind of the agendas of the small self, surrendering our complaint. So it's too hot. My face is itchy. But whatever it is. So where do we surrender our complaint? Where do we just take three steps in a bow? Or just offer the water. So what allows you to surrender your complaint? Agenda. And then how do you express your commitment to what you most value and revere? How is that expressed? And I would say, how is it expressed in both literal and non-literal ways? Maybe how do you remember it? And then how do you express it? Those are just things to consider. In the end, if we're fully with our devotional practice as one of lingering, recollecting, offering, surrendering, bowing. In doing that, we're also emptying ourselves. We're practicing and we're also forming associations, right? We're flexing the muscle of bowing and surrender, opening. So that is a very portable skill, even though we don't always have some kind of altar. We may not have the objects that we prefer in front of us. The gesture of a bow is a portable skill that we can take into our service work, our activism, our relationships, wherever we find ourselves. And as they say in Zen, on the deepest level, the giver, what's given, and the gift are all empty. So the one who makes the offering, that which we bow to, and the gesture, all of those are empty. They don't have ultimate solidity either. But we can use form and use the gestures of the heart and the body in a very skillful direction. Not towards greater self-preoccupation and concern and tying ourselves in knots, but with our own unique creative expression of opening more and more deeply. One of my teachers, Jennifer Wellwood, says, in the end, we become a devotee of reality. We become completely devoted to reality, just as it is. But this is a movement, and it can't be forced. It can't be coerced. It can't be demanded. It's a ripening of the heart into openness. Okay, I'll just all these beautiful quotes, but I'll just leave with one. So this is from Sri Aurobindo, so Indian philosopher, teacher, writer, very prolific writer. He talks about the journey of faith. The spiritual practitioner must understand that she's being born into another life, and her new eyes, her new senses are often not yet formed. Often like a newborn just coming into the world. In a way, it is like a passage to a new consciousness. The cup is left clean and empty. The only resource in these circumstances is to hold to our aspiration and to allow it to grow like a fire into which we throw all of our old clothes, our old life, our old ideas. We have to have an unshakable faith that behind this transition, a door will open. And our faith is not foolish. It is not a credulous stupidity, but a foreknowledge, something within us that knows before we do, sees before we do, and which sends its vision to the surface in the form of a yearning, an inexplicable faith. Faith is an intuition, not only waiting for experience to justify it, but leading towards experience itself. Faith is an intuition, not waiting for experience to justify it, but leading toward experience itself. So this is the part in us that yearns to open completely, right? That wholesome desire that knows what it resonates with, that knows beauty when it sees it, that knows integrity and courage and resonates, is deeply moved by that. Okay, so why don't we just sit for a minute quietly? Thank you for your attention and your practice. We'd love to hear if anyone has comments, reflections. When someone asked, Krista, I think, asked for the name of the poem I read at the beginning. The Second Music by Annie Lightheart. Yeah, Corbin.
I'm not sure I understand the difference.
So question is not understanding the difference between devotion and integrity. So I think I use the word integrity a lot just as an example of something of a value that we might hold or something inspiring that we might be committed towards. But devotion is the movement toward that, the recognition that that has value. That's something that I would like my time, attention, energy to be in alignment with. So that is something that inspires or causes the heart to resonate, or something we're deeply committed to. That we feel drawn towards, as an aspiration for life, or when we see someone else embodying that kind of integrity, there's a movement of appreciation for that. So devotion is that movement of recognition, appreciation, but also commitment. So that's where we would start to inquire, where do I feel like I'm in integrity, and where does it feel like I'm not in alignment with integrity? So devotion, again, I'm thinking of it as faith energy. So if we see somebody deeply embodying, deeply in their integrity, you know, wholeheartedly committed to non-harming or embodying the skillful, there's some confidence that that is also possible. Right? And likely some inspiration that this is something good to keep in mind. This is good to kind of orient oneself around. This is good to recollect. So all of that is the movement of devotion, but it starts with that heart resonance quality, that inspiration. Does that make sense? Okay. Thanks, my friend. Yeah. Yeah. A little bit over that.
Yeah. I really love that, what you said, God. Becoming a devotee of reality.
Yeah.
Because there's something about that that just expresses the devotional quality of this practice. You know, it isn't like devotion to a god or a goddess, or even exactly to the Buddha in a worshiping way, but the sense of really devoted to the present moment, you know, yeah. Really kind of paying attention so you really see the sacredness.
Yeah.
And that was beautiful.
Yeah.
And I, you know, that sort of opens this whole idea of devotion to me in a new way.
I don't know how much you all can hear, but Linda was appreciating the comment. One of my teachers, name is Jennifer Wellwood, talks about becoming a devotee of reality, right? As it is, and how for Linda that was helpful because we're not so much worshiping, hopefully it's clear, we're not so much worshiping a god or even the Buddha as a so much as a figure, but the reality of the present moment as it expresses itself right now in each moment. And I think also it can take some creativity to untangle ourselves from our preoccupations and the ways in which we construct reality. So I think there's a process there of allowing the heart to feel touched and uplifted by something other than its own, like, opinions and righteousness, right? So, but ultimately that's the direction, is to learn that gesture so deeply of bowing, opening, offering, that we land right here, right? surrendering our complaint. Yeah. And coming fully into alignment with that, we are in integrity, like Corbin was suggesting. We become in integrity. Carlita, did you have something?
Keep in mind for me, it's actually cheating. But I spent fairly recently some time at a Buddhist monastery. Chanting, it's a type of verse, so chanting is a big part. But yeah, at first I was just like, oh man, this is crazy. It's actually super practical.
Yeah.
Because, I learned a bunch of stuff just by following along.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. 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 Thanks for mentioning that. Carlita was talking about an experience that he's had with chanting the Thai Forest Monastery and how he's actually found it very practical. And that, because this was true, the teachings weren't written down at first. For the first few hundred years, they were all chanted and recited and told verbally, person to person. So a lot of the suttas are chanted. So it's not that you're just chanting random syllables. You're actually chanting teachings. So even though I made the point that sort of the reason and the intellect has maybe become overly dominant, there's still, you know, it's still active in a practice like chanting. There still is content and teachings that can be considered. And his other comment was that it drew the room together in a way that he hadn't experienced or that he appreciated. And this is one of the, I think, the most powerful things about chanting in my experience as well, is that you know, you don't have to be good at it. You don't have to hold a tune. You don't have to, you know, be any kind of opera singer. But there's a way that you can, everyone is fully participating, and you can hear that convergence of voices and resonance. So, and again, they're not random syllables. They have deep meaning, and they've been chanted for centuries. So it connects, for me, it connects to lineage, and it also is a way of kind of harmonizing the room, an experience of Sangha, an embodied spirit experience of Sangha. Yeah. I want to leave a little space. I know Suze has an announcement, and there might be others. Just want to see if anybody online has one quick comment or reflection before we do that. Krista?
Can you recommend a community in Seattle or an online or a DV or DVD to chant with?
Oh.
Like sources for chanting?
Yeah. So what I really enjoy, and this is again personal, so this is unique to everyone, and this is just teachers I've been drawn to and teachings and communities I practiced with. So the website of the Aloka Vihara Monastery in California, they have wonderful chanting materials. Also, and I'm sure Tweri will bring this up this month because she's practiced with these teachers, Tanisara and Kitty Sorrow.
Oh, right.
Sacred Mountain Sangha. So they have, they're wonderful embodiments and expressions of the integration of devotional practice. And they draw from a couple different traditions, and it's really powerful. It's really powerful.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, I'm sure there are many others, and you know, most traditional Buddhist practice has a devotional element to it. It's really only our westernized insight movement that's excised it almost completely. So, but I'm sure there are many, many others.